It's Ideasphere with Jennifer Michael Hecht. Stay, a history of suicide and the philosophies against it.
Say now to yourself, there may be a moment where this feeling in me wants to do this. Prepare now to say no to it. The arguments in Stay, that it's not that long a book, but I still feel I was able to get really the strongest arguments in history onto those pages. And I think that it gets the thinking started such that a person can decide whether they believe what they've heard all their lives about suicide, or if perhaps they want to rethink these ideas. Say now to yourself, there may be a moment where this feeling in me wants to do this. Prepare now to say no to it.
More people now die of suicide than car accidents. In the past 10 years, suicide rates among middle-aged Americans have risen sharply. Rates are increasing among young people worldwide, and in the U.S. military, we're losing more soldiers to suicide than combat. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with historian and poet Jennifer Michael Hecht, author of the best-selling book Doubt, 3 volumes of poetry, and The Happiness Myth. At a time when suicide rates in the U.S. are rising at alarming rates, Hecht reminds us of the compelling reasons people throughout time have found to stay alive. Ms. Hecht joins me for this program. Thanks so much for taking this time.
Thanks for having me.
I was interested in looking at your previous works, most recently Doubt, and before that, The Happiness Myth. You spend a great deal of time with your writing on what is going on in the human brain. What are we doing with ourselves here?
Yeah, someone once said to me, I'm in the business of big ideas. And it's a funny kind of thing just to look up a notice of. I don't know exactly what guides me in these directions, but I certainly find the big questions to be really compelling and fascinating. And yeah, what is the universe interests me a great deal, as it does so many, but what is the human experience of that universe? That's where I really get fascinated.
And it comes across in your writings, as I saw in The Happiness Myth, and we talked with that when it was out just a few weeks ago, it seems like. But now you're onto something that is so much more depressing in some ways.
Sure, it's dark. Oh. The book itself is very happy and very living affirming. But I will say, certainly writing the book was a kind of a hard year for me because I had to make sure that I read everything, and that meant that I had to put myself through some things that I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't put a reader who was feeling in a dark way through. But for me now, the talking about the book and reading the book is a very uplifting experience. Sharing the book with people and hearing their response is a very uplifting experience because it really, it goes through history and finds some of the most beautiful and interesting reasons to live even when we're not feeling it. And it's remarkable how many of us at times have very dark thoughts. I do. When I'm feeling depressed, my brain does suggest death. It seems pretty common, but there are certainly some people who never have that experience and who don't understand it at all. But with many people who are not what you'd call suicidal, they have suicidal thoughts sometimes. And, you know, we just don't talk about it in this culture to the point where we think of it as mentally ill to even have those thoughts. And it's really not.
Well, it's very interesting in our society, and you're right there, that we neglect the dialogue. We don't want to talk about something like this. And Sigmund Freud, 100 years ago, came out with what he called the death wish. And in that, he talks about the fact that we do have those elements that is part of who we are.
Yeah. And, you know, so you can read them in different ways. Somewhere it's a very sort of dramatic thing and complex. And in another way, it's just that life is exhausting. It makes us sad. It makes us tired. And sometimes when we're thinking about death, we're not really thinking about death. We're kind of wishing that we could just rest. And that's one of the reasons we have to talk about this, because people, when they're vulnerable, can sometimes be seduced by this feeling into not really thinking it through. You know, there's that now famous idea by Phil Donahue, that is, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Why would we need to even mention that? It seems so obvious. And the answer is that our moods don't believe in each other. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that. And especially when we're feeling bad, we forget how temporary that can be. And we really need to do some work in advance to make sure that we don't lose it all, you know, that we don't allow our worst mood to murder all our other moods.
And we can so easily. Now, there are some who feel that suicide is perhaps not necessary, but certainly understandable.
Right.
When it's a severe illness that...
Right, and I feel that way too, to the extent that I don't really even consider that suicide, and neither do most of the very vocal advocates of assisted suicide at this point. Everyone's sort of trying to find a new name for that. I speak to it as end-of-life management. You know, when we're really just deciding how cancer kills you at that point, especially in this day and age where medicine keeps you alive so long that sometimes these end-of-life decisions are really, you know, it's not even that active. It's a more passive thing of saying, let's stop intervening. So, yeah, when it's between your doctor and your spouse agrees with what you're doing and your family thinks that this is reasonable, it's a totally different category, right? Well, I'm talking about despair suicide where really your doctor nor your friends nor your family members would want this as an end for you. Everybody but you can see that you're going through a bad patch and you need to wait this through. Statistically, we've just done enough studies to know that a lot of suicide is impulsive. We think of it today as if suicide were always the inevitable end point of a biological disease called depression, and it's just not the case. So many people who do this seemed fine. They suffer some terrible reversal that feels terrible to them. Someone breaks up with them. A broken heart is a very common one, or humiliation at work or at school, so that the person just feels terrible. But those can be very short-lived if you can make it through it, which is one of the reasons if you put up a suicide barrier at a bridge, the suicide rate in that area will go down. People just don't go find another bridge. It's a profoundly impulsive thing, and we can save our own lives by doing a little work before we get into that bad place.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with author Jennifer Michael Hecht, Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Two other books, The Happiness Myth and Doubt, have previously been published. Website, blog, any recommendations for research for folks?
Yes, absolutely. My website is my name, Jennifer Michael Hecht, H-E-C-H-T. And JenniferMichaelHecht.com will bring you to my website, which will show you some reviews and responses. There's been some controversy around these books and very interesting responses from different people. I get a lot of mail from people thanking me for this work. They tell me that it helped them immeasurably to see that even if they think they're a burden, it's a worse burden to kill yourself. And so you can stay and not have to worry about it so much. But I also have seen published responses that take issue with some of these ideas, and there have been some very interesting conversations. So you can get to that at my website. And I also love to hear from people individually, and you'll find my email directly right there on my website, JenniferMichaelHecht.com.
Great.
You can also see my author's page on Amazon.com.
Perfect. And I'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange, where listeners can hear this again under Ideasphere. Or you can go to National Public Radio's podcasts, npr.org, homepage, under Ideasphere. Now you've piqued my interest, because you said you had received some criticism for some of your ideas. What would be the most common?
Well, there are people who feel strongly that it's a pillar of our humanity, of our autonomy, to be able to take our own lives. And this has been a staple in, especially in secular philosophy, but we also see it in some more religious communities where the idea of a God that would forgive this interrupts the usual religious prohibition. But certainly in the secular world, we see people arguing that since there is no religious prohibition that they find compelling, that is, they either don't believe in God or don't believe in a God that would care about this or makes these kinds of rules for people, that each of us has the right to our own lives. And this is a kind of secular mistake. What we see historically is that after the martyrdom period of ancient Christianity. When Constantine made Christianity legal in 313, the martyrdom stopped except for the suicide martyrs, which kept going on and on. And the church was losing enough people to become alarmed and to have councils that said that if you martyr yourself by suicide, you're not going into the martyrdom lists. And soon they were excommunicating suicides, telling them they had to be buried outside the church cemetery, and then torturing the corpses, drawn and quartered corpses, leaving them out to be eaten by birds and dogs, naked in the town square, confiscating the family's estate. Now, these did stop some suicides. We have records of people discussing how that happened, but it was brutal and it was gross. And when the Enlightenment came, it's not surprising that a few Enlightenment philosophers came out and said that, you know, the church should not be doing any of this. It's brutal and gross, and people have their own right over their life. And most Enlightened philosophers didn't say that. Most said what most good people say throughout history, which is, hang on. And you know, Voltaire said, wait a week, see how you feel. Diderot fought strenuously against suicide in the Encyclopedia, his famous work, saying that it hurts the other people in your community too much. It's an immoral gesture, and it hurts your future self. And these are the two big arguments I see through history, that it hurts the community too much, even fatally, we now know. Statistics bear out that one suicide really influences other people in a family, in a community, at a school, in a profession, to take their own lives. And also the idea of the future self. And that's the other big idea through history that we've sort of lost touch with because the secular argument against church interference in this matter. And I believe that we made a wrong step as secular moralists when we said this, and that we need to rethink this idea. Most rights don't argue people into the grave, you know? Most rights are about empowering the individual, not taking their lives. And I think as modern people, we need to rethink this, and especially stop telling our college students this. We're listening to Sartre over every other important historian, important philosopher through history. Socrates said, don't kill yourself, even to the people in the room when he had to drink the hemlock because he'd lost the trial. He said, you're not allowed to take your lives, to his students and friends, unless this happens to you too. Plato said you mustn't for the sake of the community, and Aristotle the same, and Montaigne. Camus, who made us so think of suicide in the modern age, also argued against it if you read the whole book. So we really have to rethink this question.
This is the philosophical side of your work, Stay. And this is the interesting thing in Discovery. We can look at the religious principles and say, well, they're based in the belief that there's an afterlife. But even if you take it to the secular side, we still understand we are all connected. And therefore, we are losing a part of ourselves every time someone leaves us through suicide.
That's right. And we're losing a part of ourselves, and we're losing someone else who we don't know, who's in despair right now and could really use to not be pushed in that direction. And those of us who sometimes feel this kind of darkness, and I count myself among them, we have to be there for each other. When you choose not to kill yourself for the sake of a community, for the sake of your children or your parents or your friends or people you don't know, you are doing such a huge contribution to the community. You're saving a life. And it's not unlike a soldier running into a firefight to save a friend. You're being courageous, and you deserve our thanks. And anyone out there who can hear me right now, thank you. I know how hard it can be.
This is interesting. You're talking about how our moods can be so overwhelming sometimes. Mm-hmm. And how short-lived those moods can be, and we can't see beyond those at times of despair.
That's right.
And I'm bringing this up because one of the highest rates of suicide is among military personnel when they're assigned for service for 2 to 4 years.
Well, it's tricky. In 2012, more military killed themselves than died in both Iraq and Afghanistan combat and transport accidents. So that shocked everyone. But I have to say that just brought them up to somewhere around the normal level. It used to be that the military was protective. And so that's part of the reason. And the other reason it got so much press is that with the military, someone's counting, as with the campuses. So we're noticing that the campuses are going up. But when we look more broadly at the culture, there's a general rise right now, too. And I have to say, with the military, a full third of them were never deployed of those suicides. And yet more than half of them had suffered a reversal of a relationship breakup or a problem at work. So it really does confirm that sometimes it is about the culture. But I've heard from some, I've got some wonderful letters and emails, and there was even a published piece in the Daily Beast about by an ex-Army Ranger who had been mourning three friends who had taken their lives, who were also had also served in the Rangers. And he was so sad about it, and he was suffering so much. And then he read a piece of mine that David Brooks had quoted in the New York Times that said, if you want your niece to make it through her dark night of the soul, you have to make it through yours. And he saw, if you want your fellow Ranger to make it through his dark night of the soul, you have to make it through yours. And he said, because of this, I'm going to accept the help that's being offered to me to not start up the cycle again. So he was being so selfless that he really couldn't see that making sure he didn't end up killing himself wasn't something he was going to take care of until he realized, my goodness, it really could be the best way to save other people's lives. And that was such a beautiful response, and smart and interesting. Of some of the really great responses, that one really moved me, because it's one of the people I've also heard from college students who said that until they realized what the statistics are in terms of one suicide leading to other suicides. One girl wrote recently and said she wished her counselor had said that, because once she found it out, it really put it out of her mind. She'd been suffering for about a year of feeling like it was up to her to decide whether she was being a burden. And now she knew, no, you know, what she had to do for herself and for the people around her was to get herself the help that she needed.
On that subject, just a moment ago, you mentioned how putting up netting at a bridge will actually diminish the suicides. There are other bridges, but for some reason, the Golden Gate is so attractive.
Yes. Well, in the 90s, in the UK, they stopped selling acetaminophen, Tylenol, in big jars. And they started making them bubble wrapped, and you could only buy a handful at a time. Now, anybody could go around to some pharmacies, buy enough, and take them home and take them out of the bubble wrap. But they didn't. The suicide rate went down, especially in, you know, that mode. But in general, the suicide rate went down because that option was no longer so easy. And, you know, in this country, more than half of our suicides are gun deaths, and more than half of our gun deaths are suicides. So, again, it's this question of means. In this country, it's men who kill themselves the most because they have the access to the guns.
Jennifer Michael Hecht, Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It, now available in hardcover. Check out our website at jennifermichaelhecht.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back. We're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with journalist and author Nell Bernstein, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. One of the remarkable discoveries you made is how imprisoned youth, despite the daunting hurdles, somehow maintain hope. In your interviews, they expressed optimism that they would somehow overcome the obstacles and continue their education, yet there is the self-esteem that's been so damaged.
Yeah, but it's true that that was one of the surprises of the research, was that the great majority of kids wanted and expected to go to college, to form families, to have careers. And I think, you know, there's a misconception that, oh, you know, these kind of kids, it's nothing for them to be locked up. They're used to it. It's a rite of passage, et cetera. But that's really not the case. They have all the same aspirations that any kid does. And sometimes I think, well, some young people said this, that even worse than entering prison was coming back out and discovering that there were a second set of invisible walls on the outside, barring them from accessing education and employment and housing and sort of branding them for life.
An element that factors in with youth incarceration is the proverbial subordinateness and superior. You're going to see abuse, mental and physical. The statistics spell out the story, yet we act as though nothing can be done to change it.
You know, there's a sense in which that's true, but I think what we do that's even worse is we act as if something can be done to change it. The stories of physical and sexual abuse, 1 in 10 kids, for example, according to official research, has been sexually assaulted by a guard. This stuff has been happening since before the dawn of the juvenile court. The very first houses of refuge reported, you know, horrific discipline, the ducking stool and things like that. And so to me, I think what's really naive or maybe even intentionally blind is, given the hundreds or thousands of reform efforts that we've been through over these two centuries, to think that in an environment that is hidden from the public and has this double disparity in power of adult to child and guard to prisoner, this kind of abuse actually can be prevented.
You ask a very good question toward the end of your book, and perhaps we can go there now. You ask, what if we spent each dollar we would otherwise have spent on incarceration to invest in the future of the child?
Mm-hmm. And I should say, I'm certainly not the first to ask that. The notion that people are calling justice reinvestment, which means we need to do more than stop doing this terrible thing to kids. We need to take some or all of the money that we're willing to spend to incarcerate a kid and invest that money in the tremendously under-resourced neighborhoods that many of the kids we lock up come from. And, you know, I asked kids a lot of questions about what rehabilitated them, for lack of a better word, but I also asked them what dehabilitated them, when and how did things go wrong. And they always pointed to, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, some kind of a loss in the family, whether it's a dad going to prison or a grandmother dying, some kind of loss and no safety net. You know, something as simple as a basketball court or a functioning school or a rec center. So, yeah, I do think that we not only need to stop damaging these young people, we need to start seeing them as the asset that they are.
Trust. That's a key you found in your research. And paraphrasing what you said is, every kid needs to have a trusting relationship with an adult.
Yeah. I mean, again, when I asked them, how did you make it? Mm-hmm. Those who did could always point to at least one relationship that was unconditional, long-term, reciprocal, and trusting. And again, this is not just me. All the research on resilience, for example, points to the same thing, which makes it, again, so counterintuitive that when young people, you know, because you hear, oh, he's just doing it for attention. Yeah, a lot of them are doing it for attention. And instead of giving them that attention, we remove all their natural relationships, replace them with relationships that are at best indifferent and often hostile, and then somehow expect them to do better. it goes against all the research, but it also goes against what we know as parents, as humans, just from basic common sense.
Quoting from one person you give several examples of in this book, he was a Massachusetts juvenile department official, Jerry Miller, and he says, anything, including nothing, was better than these institutions.
Yeah, it's funny. And he acted on his word. He was, in the 70s, he was made head of the Massachusetts system, and kind of in the same way I did, went in with the idea that he was going to clean them up and reform them and make them therapeutic. I didn't go in thinking I would do this, but that I would suggest that others do it. And discovered so much resistance, not least of all from his own staff, that he actually did shut down all of the institutions in the state of Massachusetts. And it's interesting that you bring him up, because he also said that, you know, sort of the definition of doing right by children would be to take the money we spent to incarcerate them and make sure that every dollar was invested in that child instead.
Enough to send them through a university.
Well, you know, it's funny, Eliza said that. She said they could have sent me to Harvard for what they spent to lock me up.
Ms. Bernstein, thank you so much for your time. I sincerely appreciate this, and your work is admirable.
Thank you very much.
I hope we have a chance to speak again.
I would enjoy that very much. Thank you for taking the time to do it again.
Absolutely. Without question. Take care.
Thanks.
I've been talking with journalist and author Nell Bernstein, her book, Burning Down the House. Check out our website at nellbernstein.com or burningdownthehouseblog.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for this program, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.